everybody. Welcome to another edition of Two Strike Noise, your weekly baseball history podcast. I am one of your co-hosts, Jeff. Joining me, as always, from our Seattle studios is my co-host, Mark A. Johnston. Mark, how are you doing this week?
I tell you what, man, pitchers and catchers have reported. It's like the sun shone a little brighter today. The air was a little crisper. I'm very happy and excited because I actually can smell baseball around the corner. So close, man.
Yeah, and because of that, I'm not even going to give you an option. We're going to talk about baseball history today.
Yeah, because there are very few things that could keep me from talking about baseball history today, man.
So let's start off with our BP segment. First of all, we've got a great show for you today. We're going to get you warmed up here. We have got a very special guest joining us in just a little bit. We've got Amari P. Gonzalez, who has been the Spanish voice of Major League Baseball up and down the Pacific Coast, but mainly for the Oakland A's for the past 43 seasons. He was nice enough to actually sit down with us in person after a Sabre luncheon where he was speaking and I was actually attending. And we talked about some of the great games he's covered, some of the great players he's talked to. And, you know, also, we've said it before, if you enjoy this podcast, we really encourage you to join your local Sabre chapter. You'll find a bunch of very smart, very like-minded people who are going to have a lot of great stories and great experiences like Amari does. But Mark, before we do that, let's warm up properly. Let's get some stretches in and, you know, take our time in the cage, go take some infield, and let's get started with some BP first.
All right, let's do it.
First, I want to give a shout out to somebody on Twitter. I found this about a week ago. There is an animated short film that is in the process of production right now called Curves. And what I'm really excited about is this is about something we've talked about numerous times. It is about Jackie Mitchell.
Nice.
So I've been communicating with them and following them on Twitter, and they're in the process of making this animated film. The artwork that they have is awesome. It really looks like it's going to be a pretty film, as well as just being, you know, about baseball history and Jackie Mitchell, who took to the mound. Obviously, Jackie Mitchell is a woman, if you've been listening to our shows, and, you know, struck out Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, and it's quite a thing. So I'm super excited for that. As a baseball history podcast, why wouldn't we want to talk about that?
Yeah, that sounds amazing.
You're a big Bob Gibson fan, aren't you?
Love Bob Gibson, one of my all-time favorites.
We have talked about Bob Gibson on many occasions. I found a great quote from Bob Gibson. So Bob Gibson, the final pitch of 1975, he gave up a grand slam to Pete LeCocq, who, beyond having one of the great last names in baseball, is not particularly that noteworthy beyond that. But he gave up a grand slam. It ended up being the final pitch of Bob Gibson's career. And when he decided that was it, this was his quote: "When you give up grand slams to Pete LeCocq, it's time to walk away." That's how Bob Gibson ended it right there.
Well, he's, you know, and he's got a great point.
Yeah, you cannot say he is wrong there. So, Mark, if I were to ask you, what position do you think during the course of a normal Major League Baseball game has the most balls hit to them? What would your answer be?
Center field.
Close. Shortstop.
Okay.
Shortstop is where the shortstop is going to touch the ball just statistically more than anybody else on the diamond, except for, you know, the pitcher and catcher. Balls in play. Well, Texas Rangers shortstop, do you remember Toby Hara?
Sure.
I remember that name. I think he was wrapping up his career when I kind of got into baseball. But on June 25th, 1976, he was on the Texas Rangers at the time. They were playing a doubleheader against the Chicago White Sox. And Hara became the first and only shortstop to play every inning of a doubleheader and not have a single ball hit to him.
Wow. What in the world?
That's kind of weird. Maybe a lot of fly ball pitchers. I don't know, but not a single ball.
We enjoy playing a weird game, dude. That's so strange.
That is. And that was not even maybe the strangest thing Toby Hara was known for. A year later, August 27th, 1977, a game against the Boston Red Sox, Toby Hara and teammate Bump Willis became the only players in Major League Baseball history to ever hit back-to-back inside the park home runs.
Wow.
So remember, it was almost a year ago, I feel, that we were talking about inside the park home runs, and I dug up a bunch of facts on them. I don't believe I ever mentioned back-to-back inside the park home runs, but there you go.
Very, very rare occurrence up there with back-to-back inside the park grand slams.
Very, very, very rare. And I saw just last week there was video circulating on Twitter about Tony Gwynn and his inside the park grand slam. And somebody brought up a good point, because Ricky Henderson was on second base for that and scored. And it was a little blooper to left field, and Brett Butler, it was against the Dodgers, Brett Butler dove for it and hurt himself and couldn't get up. And, you know, Gwynn, especially at the beginning of his career, had good speed. At this point, he was still pretty quick and came around for the inside the park grand slam. But somebody mentioned that Tony Gwynn is tied with Ricky Henderson for the most stolen bases in a single game in Major League history.
Really?
He stole 5 bases in one game.
Tony Gwynn, when he was younger, he was quick.
Yeah, he was. We've mentioned it. You know, he played basketball as well at San Diego State when he was in college. He's just a great athlete. I had a question for you, Mark. We've been around baseball, been fans, been involved in baseball for quite a while. What is the weirdest piece of memorabilia you've ever spent money on? Baseball memorabilia.
Spent money on. Okay, that's very different. Because I've had some weird stuff given to me.
Yes. Large screen TVs aside. Yes. Things that you have actually purchased on purpose.
I actually purchased and I at the time I was skeptical, and I'm even more skeptical now, but it was they had taken a Lou Gehrig bat and they'd cut it into pieces, and somebody was selling me the dust. They were selling the dust from cutting up the bat, you know, the sawdust. And a guy was like, "Look, man, I'll give you all the sawdust for $1." And it's a Lou Gehrig bat. And he gave it to me. And that's what, and I bought it because it was only $1, but I'm pretty sure it wasn't Lou Gehrig's bat.
How are you going to get that authenticated?
Well, that's the tough part. You know, it's, you'd have to go and do a little bit of research with the company that was making the bats, what kind of trees they had, do a little DNA research type thing. But I'm just going to go with my gut feeling and say probably not really Lou Gehrig.
So this was he was cutting up, I'm assuming, really thin slices to sell.
Yes,
and
yes.
He was selling you the sawdust
that was
from when he did that.
Yes. Half the reason I bought it for $1 was because of the story.
Well, it is $1. I got to say, I would probably do the same thing as well. I happened to be digging up. I found some boxes of my baseball stuff in the garage. I know this stuff's down there, and I've been meaning to go get it. And so I actually started looking, and I found a couple boxes. I pulled out something that I spent money on a while ago. It wasn't that much, but it is a box of cereal. When Ricky Henderson was on the Mets, they made a kind of like a Wheaties cereal. Actually, it's Frosted Flakes cereal. So I guess it's more like whatever Tony the Tiger sells. Mm. But it's called the Amazing Mets Frosted Flakes cereal. And there are pictures of several members of the Mets: John Olerud, Ray Ordonez, Al Leiter, Robin Ventura, Mike Piazza, and Edgardo Alfonso on here, along with Ricky Henderson. And so I have with me a unopened box of Mets Amazing Frosted Flakes cereal.
Yum.
I don't know how much I paid for it. I am looking at it right now on eBay. It's $4.
But you probably, it's like the in Waxpax Heroes, you don't want to eat the gum.
Well, I don't know. If it's sealed well enough, it might be good, but I'm going to pass on trying to eat it. But so that's hey, if listeners, if you've got something, what is the strangest thing you have ever spent money on in terms of baseball memorabilia? It I I've got to assume people have probably done sillier things than buying sawdust.
maybe.
All right, so let's focus on the minor leagues. What we've been doing here since Major League Baseball announced that they are going to try to unaffiliate 42 minor league baseball teams in not this upcoming season, but possibly the next season. We've been trying to spotlight some of these teams to kind of show the history and just what minor league baseball brings, especially to these small towns where these minor league teams reside. So this week's team is the Williamsport Crosscutters.
Oh, the Crosscutters.
The Crosscutters were founded in 1994 when the Geneva Cubs moved from Geneva, Switzerland. Wait, nope, check that. Nope. Not Geneva, Switzerland.
Oh, okay.
Geneva, New York. They moved to Williamsport, Pennsylvania, where they became known as the Williamsport Cubs. Because believe it or not, they were a Cubs franchise at that point. I know that's a stretch. Then in 1999, the Pirates took over, and they decided to rename the team. The Pirates minor league team did not want to be known as the Williamsport Cubs. Another shocker. I'm going to guess they probably held a contest to rename the team. And they became the Crosscutters.
Nice.
The Crosscutters is an homage to the logging heritage of Williamsport, which was once known as the lumber capital of the world. At one point, the city also had the largest amount of millionaires per capita in the entire country. Yeah.
That's crazy. Okay.
And still today, the Williamsport Area High School, all their sports teams are known as the Millionaires to this day.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Sometimes they're also referred to as the Ted DiBiase's, though.
Oh, yeah. The million-dollar school.
So they play their home games at BB&T Ballpark at historic Bowman Field, which is the second oldest minor league ballpark still in use in the United States. The oldest of which is, and I had to do a lot of research here. I found many differing points of view as to what constitutes an old ballpark still in use. But from what I can tell, the Centennial Field in Burlington, Vermont, which officially opened on April 17th, 1906, is the oldest. It is still the home to the Vermont Lake Monsters of the New York Penn League.
The Lake Monsters.
The Lake Monsters, yes.
Nice.
The Crosscutters have had several different mascots throughout their history. They started off with Kid Cub, then Rusty Roughcut, and now for the past 11 years, it's been Boomer. Which that nickname's kind of taken a different turn in the past year. Pat Borders was the manager last season of the Crosscutters. Remember Pat Borders, catcher for the Blue Jays mainly.
Pat Borders is like a legend in Toronto.
Yeah, and he played for the Mariners at one point too, didn't he?
Yes, he was in Tacoma, and he also got called up to and did play for the Mariners. Yes.
So Pat Borders. I don't know if you remember this. I remember this specifically from the 1989 ALCS. Pat Borders, when he was on the Blue Jays, just stopped trying to throw out Ricky Henderson on the bases.
Did he really?
Yeah, if you remember, Ricky was the MVP of the 89 ALCS. And I remember Pat Borders said, I'm not going to try to throw him out anymore. I can't. So I remember Ricky started like stealing second base and he wouldn't slide. He would just run and stand up as he went into second because the ball was not going to be thrown.
Oh, that's funny.
Some notable alumni from the Crosscutters, Jose Bautista, Reese Hoskins, Andrew McCutcheon, and maybe most notably, previous guest on the show and host of the Turn a Pair Baseball podcast, our buddy Chris, who was an intern there, if you remember.
Very nice.
So there you have it, the Williamsport Crosscutters, another one of those 42 teams that MLB is trying to do away with.
Not on our watch.
Not on our watch is right. Williamsport also, that's where the Little League World Series is, every year, right?
Sure.
So they've got other baseball, but I think they probably won it the whole season.
Right.
All right, so let's go to our trivia question. Last week, I asked you to name the Hall of Famer with the lowest career batting average.
Yes.
Were you able to figure out who that was?
Well, I never Googled it. So I remember guessing, I believe I guessed Luis Aparicio last week.
I believe you did guess that, yes. And that is incorrect.
Okay.
The answer is Willard Brown.
Willard Brown, not familiar.
No, I wasn't either. He played only 1 year in the majors, and he batted only 179.
Okay.
But Willard Brown was also known as Home Run Brown, and unfortunately, because, you know, baseball in this country was kind of backwards, only got the chance to play a single year in the big leagues. He spent most of his career in the Negro Leagues, where he was, just an incredible an incredible player. He played with the Monarchs, the Kansas City Monarchs. He was kind of an equivalent to Josh Gibson. Okay. And actually, Josh Gibson is the one who gave him that name of Home Run Brown. So I thought that was really interesting. That is the answer to your question. Willard Brown, the lowest career batting average.
Very interesting. You always find some tidbit that I have zero chance of answering correctly. I appreciate that.
Well, here's another one, because now we got to give you the question for this week. So who was the first player to ever have their number retired?
Oh, wow. That's a good question. I don't know.
So I'm going to let you think on that. The first one to ever have their number retired. All right, so we're going to wrap up our BP right now. Let the grounds crew come out and do their thing. And while they do that, we are going to welcome our special guest. All right, so we'd like to welcome our very special guest this week. He's a member of the Cuban Sports Hall of Fame, the Hispanic Heritage Baseball Hall of Fame, and the Bay Area Radio Hall of Fame. And he is currently the voice, the Spanish voice, of the Oakland Athletics. He is Mr. Amari P. Gonzalez. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeff. My pleasure.
So we've talked about the Cuban Baseball League several times on our show. We have no point of reference for it other than, you know, what we read. You were born in Cuba. You grew up going to baseball games there. Can you tell me a little bit about your history with baseball in general, but especially growing up in Cuba?
Well, I left, I was 17 years old. There was a change of government, the Castro Revolution. I didn't know politics from Adam, but my parents sent me to Miami to live with my aunt. So I became what they call a Cuban refugee. I became a citizen since then. But I always loved baseball. My dad introduced me to the round robin, four teams in Cuba that play Saturday and Sundays. And I loved that league. I talked to some gentlemen in some affairs like this here with Saver, who knew Cuba, and they told me that was almost close to the major league caliber. As a matter of fact, I saw Brooks Robinson, in my opinion, the greatest third baseman defensively. He won all the Golden Gloves in the world. He played in Cuba. I saw him play Bob Allison, Jackie Brandt. A lot of American players play in Cuba. So I always have that point of reference. Then when I went to Miami in 1961, a friend of mine says, you want to work for the Orioles? I said, what am I going to do for the Orioles? I didn't even know the Orioles were in Miami. Spring training home. I became a ball boy and a bat boy. And there I met Brooks Robinson. I said, I saw you play. I was a little kid. I couldn't go on the field. Now I'm in the field giving you the bats. I saw Gus Triandos, Dave McNally, all those guys. I mean, some great players from the Orioles in the early 60s. They didn't win anything until Earl Weaver in the 69, the World Series. But my introduction to baseball was quick, from Cuba to the United States.
You saw Brooks Robinson play in Cuba. Did major league players come down in the off season and play in Cuba?
They did. And I talked to some of those players who retire. One of the reasons, I have no idea how much money Brooks Robinson made with the Orioles in the late 50s and 60s. But of all the Cuba, although the Caribbean leagues, Cuba was regarded as number one, primo. The best salaries were paying Cuba. So a lot of American players, remember, there was no union. There was no Marvin Miller. There was no union in baseball. So some of these players needed another job in the winter for revenue. Some work at a Texaco station, whatever they have to do, right? And a lot of Cuban players, American players went to Cuba but only the good players. I remember that they were not rookies. They were guys established. One of the reasons they went is because they needed to augment their salaries. They make some good money for, what, 3-4 months, a winter league. It was not like the big leagues.
You have been broadcasting Major League Baseball for 43 years, you
That's
said
right.
today. You started with the A's, and you had to talk directly to the then A's owner, Charlie Finley.
He was wild. I mean, he was wild, and I think tell the story, you might heard it, but when I got started, a friend of mine, Al Doherty, rest in peace, he was a salesman at the station, and he says, Maury, you're a writer, can you, you can broadcast games? I said, sure, let's talk to Charlie, we can get him. So anyway, make a long story short, we sent him a letter, and then he told me, Maury, you can broadcast in Mexican. And I was, I didn't want to say anything because I haven't been hired yet. He might fire me before I might insult the guy. But Mexican is not a language, it's a nationality. Latin America, I got like 23 countries. Most speak Spanish. Here's the irony. The largest country in South America, they speak Portuguese in Brazil, right? Yeah. But anyway, he wasn't a major in geography. He was just a rude owner who didn't want to pay his players. As you know, they all left. Reggie Jackson left for the Yankees. I met Catfish Hunter with a Yankee. I talked to him for a few minutes when he came back to Oakland. So I started in 1979. Actually, I broadcast in 77, but in 79, it was the second time in the history of the Bay Area that a local team didn't have a local station. This year, the Oakland A's are on TuneIn. They're not on radio. And that year, I broadcast in the weekends, three games, Friday night, Saturday, and Sunday, usually, from the Oakland Coliseum in Spanish for KBRG 105.3 FM. And to my left, doing the games for the A's, was Larry Bear, who's a big executive now with the San Francisco Giants. The reason was that Finley, so eccentric, he didn't want to sell the rights to a commercial station. He was selling the team anyway to the Haas family the next year. So he sold the rights for $1, you know, symbolic, to the University of California, Berkeley, the campus. And every time I see Larry, I say, Larry, you weren't a big shot then. He said, you're right, Maury. So anyway, so that's how I got my start. And then I did more games. Since then, I worked for the Mariners. I started the broadcast there. Julio Cruz started with me there, and a great guy, great baseball guy. And I also done the Angels. I did TV until 3 years ago. I was doing Ace Radio, 81 home games, and traveling to Anaheim to do the Angels on TV. We were a whole production, and Jose Mota was my partner. Probably, with all respects to Julio and everybody else I work with, the best color man I worked with as far as commentary was Jose Mota. He was raised with the Dodgers, you know. And I done also the Giants. I was with the Giants during the Dusty Vecchia era in the 90s. I traveled with the Giants. And what else? That's it. I did the Angels. I did the Mariners, the A's, and the Giants. I'm the only guy who's done four teams.
And you did a couple of times. You did double duty.
Yes.
For two teams.
Yes.
In a single season. That's crazy.
I think Larry Stone, who I heard his name today, who used to be from the Bay Area.
Now he's in Seattle.
He wrote a story about that. You probably Google it, but somebody wrote a story, the hardest working man in baseball. And I was, my commute. When I work in L.A., I hear people, my commute was 2 hours. I said, look, I drive 400 miles to come here. So they lose stuff. Yeah, you're unique. But I did two teams at the same time. I was doing, until 2017, I was doing radio for the A's. And I was flying to Anaheim to do the home games on TV for the Angels. So this business is so fluid now with the internet and television and YouTube. It's just, when I started, it was just newspapers, the game of the week, you know, and radio. And radio still should be the main thing in baseball because so many games, you know, and it's like a babysitter. But it's unique that the Bay Area doesn't have, the Oakland A's don't have an English flagship station this year.
You've also called Caribbean World Series.
2 years, yes, with Jose Tolentino in English language on TV. We did the voice, everything on TV. I didn't travel, they didn't send me. I think one was from Mexico, one from Venezuela. We went to a studio in Century City, you know, Hollywood, and we sat there in an air condition. And then we followed, we had the lineups in advance.
Sure.
So it was just fun. But I wasn't there. But I broadcasted in English language. They wanted people who can pronounce the Spanish names, you know, whatever. And I took the job. You know,
that's very similar to the Cuban League. Is something that we've talked about, especially this off season. But have just no point of reference. It's not broadcast on easily accessible TV here in the U.S. What is I worked the World Baseball Classic last, the finals in the Dodgers, and it was so fun because the Dominican team, their fans were, I just walked around in pregame and they're singing and dancing and chanting the whole game. Can you kind of describe the differences between just a typical, even major league game, but in those games in that league?
Well, it's really little comparison. Baseball is so much, people, I don't know the words, coy, but calm, you know, they only get excited when a home run comes in or with the bases loaded or walk off. Latin America is like a party. In the Dominican, Cuba, it's the same thing. And my dad, to tell you a short story, my dad, we were for the Havana Lions. That was our team. And our neighbor was with the Scorpions, Almendares, a long word, the Scorpions, they were blue. The Reds, the Havana Lions were red. And sometime my dad, and usually the blue guy, the blue team, the Alacatanes, the Almendares, they used to win most of the time. And sometime my dad wouldn't talk to his neighbor. They were good friends. They play dominoes and smoke Cuban cigars, and they come to live in a house one day to eat in the house and vice versa, but they wouldn't talk to each other like the Dodgers and the Giants, you know, that type of, or the Red Sox and the Yankees. So the passion is deep in Latin America. Of course, it's less team. And I'll be honest, of course, there's no quality like the major leagues. This is the best baseball in the world. But Cuba was the first team, if you research this, in the 1800s, the first Latino player was Esteban Bayan, an Irish-Cuban guy born in Havana who played with the Troy Haymakers of the All-American Association, who later became the National League in 1876. So Cuba always had the tradition. But no, there's no comparison when you go to a Caribbean World Series or baseball series, when those teams play even among each other. Forget it, when it's Panama against Cuba, there's more of a rivalry because it's two different countries. The same language, but different, little different culture, different music. They might have salsa, mambo, whatever. It's just, it's fascinating. It really is. I'm sad that the American public doesn't get to, that no network in the United States televise those series. The World Baseball Classic, yes. But the others, they should televise the Caribbean series. They don't do it anymore.
Major League Baseball wants players, they say they want players to show more personality.
Right.
If they show that, then some Major League players see that and say, oh, maybe I don't have to throw at a guy because he flipped a bat. I think it would be a great idea.
You know, maybe it's because in the big leagues, we used to, these players all make millions of dollars, right? And sometimes, as I've seen it, you've seen it, a pitcher throws inside a hitter, the hitter charges the mound. Here's a point I want to make. I remember in Cuba, there were brawls, but not like that. It was somebody said something to another guy, called his mother or something. You know, it was something ugly. It was never about the game itself. You get hit, you get hit. Minnie Minoso was my favorite player. He played for 5 decades, from 1949 to 1980. I got the privilege and honor to meet him. He sat with me in Chicago in 2005 and doing commentary during the game. He said, I feel like I'm in Cuba with you. Of course, I'm Cuban. We're talking. Huh? So it's completely different, the mentality. You know, you fight for the game. You want to get. There's as much passion in the Caribbean as there is in New York or Kansas City. However, the passion is more, I don't want to say normal, but it's less volatile as in the big leagues. You know, of course, I have to take into consideration that Cuba is a small island. You know, Puerto Rico is a small island. A game here is televised. You can have 5 million people watching. So it's a lot of pride, personal stuff. But you don't see, you see the passion in Cuba, but you don't see all those brawls like you see here in the United States so often.
Beyond the Caribbean World Series, you've also done a couple of Major League Baseball World Series, and I see you, I'm very jealous, I see you're wearing a 1989 Oakland A's World Series ring.
Yes, sir. I was at Candlestick Park, October 17, 1989, about 5:05 in the afternoon when the earth started moving. And I was being a Catholic, crossing myself. Well, adios, muchachos. This is my last. I have to call my wife. And there was no cell phones then. So, that's a long story. That's another show, like they say. But, yeah, the other day I went home, and my wife helps me. God bless her, Gail. She's here with me. I think I called 10 to 12 World Series. I might be more exact. I confess I'm not prepared to tell you. I know I did the 77. I did the 81, the 86 for CBS, Hispanic Network, with a couple of guys who had passed already. I was there at the mic. I was doing commentary because we take turns. Juan Benet was doing the broadcast in the 86 World Series when Mookie Wilson hit a ground ball that went right through the legs of Billy Buckner at first base. And Billy Buckner was persona non grata in Boston for years. Mm-hmm. And then they lost. That was a 6th game. Then the Mets won the next game and, you know, they won the World Series. So I've done a lot. I did the 89. I did the 88, the 90. And now that you're talking about that, the A's should have won those three because Tony La Russa. And Tony La Russa, bless his soul. I mean, well, he's alive. I'm sorry. He doesn't live far from here. He's alive. He was born the same day and the same year as me, October 4, 1944. So every time I see Tony in an event, I said, Tony, see who's looking younger. Because he always had a Prince Valiant haircut. He got more hair than me. Yeah, I'm balding here. But we joke, you know. He's a very brainy manager, yeah. But I tell it to his face in Spanish, you had won those three World Series. I know, but it's baseball, you know. So I thought that the 88 team was the best we had. And in those three, that's the one, the first game, what's his name? Jose Canseco hit the home run in the first inning. Dave Stewart was pitching. The A's were winning like the way they won, I think, 108 games. It was a microcosm how the A's won those years. Mm-hmm. And Eckersley, the best reliever at that time, he was going to close the game. And then Kirk Gibson, that's what baseball is so beautiful. Kirk Gibson, he couldn't even take batting practice. And then Tommy Lasorda said, oh, I know he was going to do it. Come on, that's a lot of bravado. And I love Tommy. He speaks Spanish. I talked to him. That's the beauty of baseball. But the 1988 A's were so superior to the 1988 Dodgers. I mean, they get no comparison. And look what happened. So that's the beauty of baseball. Well, I think, I cannot tell you for sure, I have covered at least 12. I might have broadcast, because I cover some other ones as a reporter. I have broadcast at least 7 or 8 World Series. All the A's so far, yeah.
Well, I mean, think of that. You've been at the 86, which that was the first World Series I really remember. Yes. That was my first year of baseball.
That was a great moment.
Incredible World Series. Yeah. You went at the 89, you had the earthquake. And then in the 70s, you had the Yankees teams.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, you've really done some big World Series games. What's the biggest game you covered that you kind of sticks in your memory the most?
The one I just made the commentary, the 88 first game, because the way the Dodgers won, I remember telling my partner Avelio, the way the Dodgers won this game, this doesn't feel like a first game. It felt like a seventh game or a fourth game sweep, the way they won it. And that's what happened. So that, for me, I never forget that. Of course, the 17th of October, 1989, the earthquake here at Candlestick Park, and Faye Vincent was the interim commissioner. He postponed the series for 11 days. I said, no, there's not going to be any series. But they made a good decision for the morale, you know, of the Bay Area. That was, for me, a moment, seminal moment in my career, because I really thought that building was going to go down. Candlestick Park checked pretty well. And that, since then, knock on wood someplace, is the biggest earthquake we had in the Bay Area since 1906. We weren't around for that one.
Especially in the past 20 to 30 years, players from Cuba have really become a lot more prevalent in the major leagues. Do seeing these players succeed, is that something that I'm assuming you've got some national pride there, seeing these players come up?
I saw the first time Canseco batted in Oakland, and everybody knew he was a legend. He played in Huntsville. He would tell me in Spanish, I hit a home run there, the ball hasn't come down yet. So, okay, Jose, whatever you say, I believe you. I wasn't there. So, but for me, I was very proud. However, and that's a good question, Canseco left Cuba as a toddler, as a very small kid. His Spanish was not that good. And he used to ask me, how do you say this in Spanish? He said, come on, you're born in Cuba. But I met his dad who passed. His dad said, he's a good kid. I knew about him. I never saw him play in the minors. But his dad told me later, and he used to drink milk. And every day was a very wholesome person. And then I heard about the steroids. That's the first time I heard about that. And then the books he wrote, or somebody wrote for him, McGuire, the Bash Brothers. For me, Canseco was a great figure in my career. However, in my life, Mini Minoso was my favorite player. No doubt about it. He played with abandon. I remember he told me, just to wear the White Sox flannel was enough for me. You know, I wouldn't get paid. I said, don't tell that to the owner, because he might not pay you, right? And I remember in Cuba, and this, my memory, 1957, 58, I was a kid. I read in the papers, because I always follow the game, Minoso signed with the White Sox for $25,000. That was a scandal. You know how much money? $25,000, I think, was the first $100,000 was DiMaggio, I believe, you know, and later or whatever. So it was a fortune for a Cuban player. So Minoso, and then I met him in the United States. I saw him play in Cuba. My dad used to take me to the Winter Leagues, but I never met him. I met Yasiel Puig when he was a rookie a few years ago. I was doing the Angels TV, and we visited Dodger Stadium for the Freeway Series. Mm-hmm. And then I told him the next time I saw him, I said, when you play, enjoy the game. But, you know, unfortunately, every time they put a camera on Yasiel, he pulls his tongue out, and he goes crazy. And there's no need for that. So I feel, I mean, come on, relax. But that's L.A., see? He's a good, great player. I think Yasiel Puig got the potential to be an MVP. I really do. Great arm, terrific speed. He can bunt, he can hit home runs. but his attitude, you know, and that's, you know, he got paid so much, it's different. It's a big cultural shock for a player in Cuba who plays at the pleasure of the government, because there's no professional sports in Cuba, maybe making $50 a week, whatever, equivalent, right? And then comes here, makes $50 million for 4 years. That's also tough. God help me, if I was 22 years old making that type of money at 21 years of age, I don't know what I would do, right? You want the Lamborghini and you want the girls. So it's a big difference. If you're raised and born in this country, you understand the culture. But coming from Cuba, who is such a poor country, it's a communist country, it's a close society, really, for 60 years to this country. But everybody in Cuba knows the best baseball is in the United States. That transcends politics. Everybody knows that.
So you told me previously you did some, you translated for Jose Canseco.
Yes.
Even though he didn't really speak Spanish.
Yeah, it's nervous tick all the time. Yes, I translated for him a couple of times and he thanked me. I helped him and he was grateful. Every time I see him, he comes to me, hey, ¿qué pasa? How are you? You know, he tried to talk. Ah, now you speak Spanish. Canseco, I feel like he's one of my sons. I know he's not, but I feel like he's one of my kids. He was a special player for me, because I saw his power. Because see, when I was a kid, 90% of the Latin players were punch and judy hitters, right? They were not sluggers. And then you saw Canseco, like Paul Bunyan, you know, at the plate. It's like Mickey Mantle. I saw Mantle as a kid when I lived in New York. When I came, I moved to New York and served in the Army. I saw those guys. And to see Canseco in person and to talk to him, for me, I feel like he's my family. I really do. And every time I reach, I pray to God, I don't want to hear anything bad about him. Yeah, because when he was in the Bay Area, he was arrested for driving with no license and with a gun in his seat. So I tell him, why do you do that? And then he told me in spring training once, everybody's following me. So, well, I wonder why. You got a Diablo Lamborghini with gold plates and you say 40-40 in your... He is a piece of work. I love Jose and I wish him nothing but the best. But he is quite a story. So he was very naive. I'm going to say that because I know he was. He was. And he did stuff like a little kid. You know, that shouldn't do it. But I get a kick at him. One day, I remember, after a game, the next day, he said, do you watch a game? And, yeah, I was calling the game. He says, ESPN, that's when ESPN became big, right? They say that was 425. It's about like 450, right? I said, why do you care? Went over the fence. He went over the fence, okay? I don't know. I said, it was a tremendous poke, right? And then I said, and the radio got excited. But he says, they say it was 425. Are you taking note of that? Who cares? But that was the time that everybody wanted to hit the ball. And I still love Jose. And every time, a few years ago, Gail and I, my wife, we were on vacation in Vegas. And we went upstairs to the room. My wife says, I think I saw Jose Canseco. I said, honey, you don't drink. Are you sure? I went down. He was signing autographs there. And then he saw me. So, because I know they make money with that. Now, this is recent, maybe 10 years ago. He was retired. But he was signing autographs. I think it was Paris, a big hotel with the Eiffel Tower. And he said, yeah, I'm here for 2 hours. You need anything? I said, no, I got your autograph. He said, okay, so go home. We'll go to your wife. So he's Jose is a nice man. I hate when they write nasty stuff. And look, if he took that stuff, Barry Bonds probably took it. He hit 762 home runs. But in that time, the best player I saw in the American League was Ken Griffey Jr. during that time. That was the best. But for me, Canseco has a special place in my heart. I like the guy. And I wish I could be his agent, make some extra money, because I would defend him, because I know what I'm saying. And he's not crazy. He just acts like that sometimes.
Follow on Twitter. Oh, he has got some thoughts about a lot of things. Well, he also has just opened a car wash, he'll tell you about.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, in Vegas. Yeah.
Wow. I had no idea. Well, there you go.
You also told a great story about your favorite player, Minnie Minoso, and some of the most iconic Chicago White Sox uniforms of all time.
Yes, 1980, the White Sox got an all-black uniform, or shorts. They were shorts, and he was in Oakland. And I say, oh, I want to talk to you. You know, sure. He was already playing 1980, so that's his fit. He played 49. He was a rookie with the Cleveland Indians. They play in the 50s, 60s, 70s. Yeah, that was his fifth decade. He was at the end. It was almost like a promotion. I said, oh, those uniforms, they look good on you. He said, no. Why? Why do you say that, Minnie? Because my knees are so ugly and the girls don't like it. Minnie, you're 71. You know, come on. I mean, but he Nobody, I never heard a bad thing about Minnie Minoso. He loved the game. He was here with us. He would sit here and talk to you. He's down to earth, you know, great people's guy. I respect that. Never went to his head. He was the most popular player in Cuba at the beginning, you know, when the big leaguers were making a little money. Like I said, 25 grand was a fortune in the late 50s. Camilo Pascual, a great pitcher for the Washington Senators, Pedro Ramos. Then Tony Perez came later. Cuba had some great players, great players. And now there's more coming because, you know, the government understands these guys, you better let them go. It was political before, it's not anymore. I think Cuban government wanted to charge a percentage to the major leagues, and I think the major leagues, they didn't go for that, but whatever, they understand. Plus, they're Cuban, so they make Cuba look good, whatever they play, right? And so, but yeah, Miniman also unique guy, and I told you that in 2005, I was traveling, doing radio with the Angels before I did TV, and he sat with me because Jose Mota, after the seventh inning, have to go downstairs to do post games in English for Fox. So I would be doing a solo. So every time I travel, I can find a player like in Minnesota. The guy was Tony Oliva. They love to sit with you, Oliva. Three titles in the first 3 years. One of the best hitters I ever saw. He was also from Cuba. Minnie Minoso is a special person, my favorite player. And my favorite American player is Brooks Robinson, because of when it's like your first girlfriend, your first kiss, right? When I came to the United States, I worked for the Orioles as a ball boy, you know, as a bad boy. And I saw the Orioles, as for me, the Orioles were like God, you know? And I just became enamored, that's the word, right? And I don't root for them, but I like them to see good. That's why last year they were terrible. And every time I see Jim Palmer, he said, we can't win. He says, I wish you were playing. I asked Jim Palmer, I said, you played for 20 years. You never gave up a grand slam. He says, I walk him. That's what he told me. I said, I walk him. That makes sense. It's only one run. So you force a run. But so I always liked the Orioles. It's like your first love, you know, when I came to this country. But yeah, Minoso, for me, there's nobody. And being from Cuba, I'm very proud. There's more Cuban players coming now, yes.
You mentioned Brooks Robinson.
Yes.
The vacuum at third base. Yes. Gold gloves just everywhere.
Yes.
So I want to ask you and compare him. You say he's the best third baseman you've ever seen defensively.
Yes.
You get to call the best defensive third baseman in the game now in Matt Chapman.
Yes.
How do you compare? And we'll even bring in Nolan Arenado.
Yes.
From the National League.
Yes.
How do those two compare? Because I never got to see Brooks Robinson play in person. How do those two compare?
Brooks Robinson was in the class by himself. Yeah. Although Arenado wins a Gold Glove every year, right? And Chapman probably could do it in the American League. Bregman is good, but I think Chapman is better than Alex Bregman. You know, the thing about Brooks Robinson, Jeff, he didn't have a lot of speed. He was a double play in the on-deck circle, right? He was,
yes.
Yeah, basically. But he was a clutch hitter. You check his numbers, like a 280 with runners in scoring position. He said 280. In those days, 280 was 280, okay? Now, guys hitting 232, and they put a shift on the right side. Ted Williams is turning around in his grave. It's a different type of baseball. But no, I think Brooks Robinson was a better. I haven't seen another guy that covers as much ground. Brooks Robinson will go for a ball next to third base, behind the bag, picked it up. His body inertia would carry him to the foul ground and throw from out there. You mentioned Arenado, Chapman, but I have not seen in my whole life a better third baseman defensively, because Mike Smith can hit more. But defensively than Brooks Robinson, no. And I think there's nobody yet to play with a glove like Brooks Robinson.
I will take your word for it. I enjoy watching Chappie play, but I will take your word for it.
I know, yeah, and I like to ask Chappie, and well, he never saw him. Obviously, he's a young man too, like you. But I don't think the next Brooks Robinson, maybe he's born, but he's not playing.
All right, my final question is a purely selfish question.
Sure.
I am a Ricky Henderson fan. I, you know, grew up watching him play in person and then followed his career. Everybody's got a Ricky Henderson story. What is your? Do you have a Ricky Henderson story we might not know?
Well, for me, first of all, I want to say I started with the A's. I'm doing the A's now. I don't know the teams in between. 1979, I saw him in left field when he was a rookie. For me, he's the most complete baseball player the Oakland A's have had, not the Philadelphia or Kansas City. For me, he's the best. With all respect to Canseco, Maguire, those were power guys. Canseco was a speed guy too, 40-40. Ricky he asked me once about Dwayne Murphy. He used to play center field.
Absolutely,
you know?
Yeah.
And he called him Frente de Chivo. Frente de Chivo is in Venezuela. His forehead is like a goat. And he was joking, and I can make a story. It's a long story. And that Ricky, we have to, I have some I written about Ricky, but he liked to joke a lot, you know, and he doesn't, but he called me Chief, hey Chief. But Ricky Henderson, for me, was the best player the Oakland A's ever had. The best story I can tell you about him is in spring training when he was stealing bases. I said, what do you do that for? I said, wouldn't you do it? I'm the king. I have 14. He knew, I don't want to say arrogant, because Muhammad Ali said, I'm the greatest of all time, right, in boxing. And Ricky, I was in Oakland that time too when he broke Lou Brock's record. It was against, I can't remember the year, the Yankees. It was third base. Yep. It was an afternoon game. It was humid for Oakland, for California. He raised the bag and said, I'm the greatest of all time. And he was criticized. And I talked to him after that, and he said, no, I am the greatest. I said, you're right, you know. So, but he wasn't that funny, but he likes to joke a little bit, very subtle. He would say something, and I'm waiting for an interview. He'd tap me in the shoulder and run away so I cannot see him. And then, hey, you know, it's crazy. But no, and Ricky, number 24, for me, he's the best Oakland A's I've seen. And I saw Campy at the end of his career. He's a good friend, Dagoberto Campanelis. But he would tell you Campy, he would tell you Ricky's probably the best Oakland A's player. I'm talking overall. He's in the Hall of Fame, 1,400, I think, six stolen bases, yeah. Something like that. But not a home run hitter, but he hit third for the Yankees. He played for 25 years. I mean, Ricky, one of a kind, the best lead, for me, the best leadoff hitter in history, you know, probably for a lot of people, you know. But very quiet, but subtle humor. Yeah, you'll know when he was coming from.
All right, so now I've got with me here, I've got a pack of 1989 Tops.
Oh, boy.
And I've told you what we do with this. We open these with our guests, right. And especially I think you'll be really good at this. We just kind of, you know, anything that we remember about the player, we talk about it. This is a Beckett's baseball card, right. From 1992.
Okay.
And the reason we use this is so that these cards will have some value. Because
sure.
If we use a current one,
sure.
they don't. They're not really worth anything.
Okay.
We also have a couple of other rules. If the player has a mustache,
right.
It's an extra cent, because a lot of players had mustaches, okay. At this point. If the player is a Hall of Famer, it's an extra 5 cents.
Mm-hmm.
If they're wearing real stirrups, it's an extra cent. But if they're wearing those fake ones like Jose used to wear, you know, right. The 2-in-1s, it's a -1 cent.
Okay.
And so we'll open up this pack.
Okay, here we go.
If you want the gum, I can give it to you, but I, you know,
no,
this,
okay.
Is, this is
no problem.
30-year-old, 40-year-old,
yeah,
gum at this
little,
point.
Yeah.
So, all right, well, here we go. Here's a Hall of Famer to start off with the Brewers, Robin Yount.
Robin Yount, I think he was 19 years old when he came to the big leagues, right?
Yeah, he was very young.
He was one of the youngest shortstop. That's right, yeah, class. I mean, of course, a Hall of Famer. I saw him play most of his career.
And I think he had a brother that came up and played one game and got hurt.
I heard
never,
that, but yeah.
Never came back. So let's see. That card, I would hope it's got to be worth something. So that's 7 cents.
Okay.
But he's a Hall of Famer, so that's 5. And he's got a mustache, so that's another 6. So that's a strong start right there at 13 cents. Now, this guy I have never heard of for the Toronto Blue Jays, Sil Campesano.
He was a role player, a bench. He wasn't an everyday player, I don't think. I would tell you, I don't think he played 50 games in the season. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, this is his rookie card, so it's worth 2 cents.
Okay.
And he's got a mustache. So this is an extremely strong start, I'm going to tell you.
Good.
Right,
I'm going to leave it off. Okay.
All right. Here, I remember this guy's a catcher for the Pittsburgh Pirates, Tom Prince.
Yeah, I remember him, the Prince. Yeah, I cover mostly American League, though, so you have to give me an out here. But I think he was a pretty good catcher.
Yeah, I think he was a kind of a career backup guy.
Right.
No mustache, can't see his stirrups, and that's not worth anything.
Not worth anything, yeah.
Oh, now, this guy, my co-host, has a lot of stories about. My co-host, Mark, was a bat boy for the Tacoma Tigers and Rainiers. This is catcher for the Minnesota Twins. He finished up with the A's, Brian Harper.
Yeah, he was a good catcher. I think so. Isn't Joe Mauer follow him, I think, right?
I think there were a couple of guys,
in between.
Yeah, but he was on the 87
okay.
World Series.
Yeah. Not a superstar, but a good player. He was a good player, yeah.
Yeah, he was their starter.
That's right.
Let's see.
Yeah,
that card is not worth anything, but he does have that mustache, yeah. So you get 1 cent from that. Oh, here's a guy, Ellis Burks. We've talked about him a lot.
Well, with the Boston Red Sox, he then played for the Rockies. He was part of the what would they call him, the Blake Street Bombers.
Blake Street Bombers, yeah.
Dante Bichette, Ellis Burks, and...
Andres Galarraga.
Andres Galarraga, the cat, El Gato Grande. That's right. Yes, I remember. No, he was a good player.
Yeah.
Not Hall of Famer, but he was a very, very good player.
No, yeah, he was solid. Yeah, he played in Japan a little bit, too. We've touched on that, right. But yeah. Here we go. The brother of a Hall of Famer, but longtime pitching coach.
A good pitching coach.
Mike Maddox.
Well, when you're the brother of Greg Maddox, it's like we're the son of Frank Sinatra. I mean, it's hard to top that, right?
Yeah, you no matter what you do, you're probably not gonna equal.
I'm sure that I like to know they have when they were growing up, right? Because they're very close in age, right?
Yeah,
that rivalry. I would love to talk to the parents because Mike Maddox and Greg Maddox, with all respect to Mike is remembered as a pitching coach. Greg as one of the best control pitchers of all time.
Absolutely.
Truly Hall of Famer.
We forgot to mention the Ellis Burks card was worth 4 cents, and he's got a mustache. Oh. That's 5 cents.
Yeah, that's good.
This Maddox card is worth 1 cent. Okay. Or no, it's worth nothing, but he's got real stirrups and a mustache. So you got two on that. Here's a guy. I remember this guy.
Dennis Lamp.
I think he was on the 86 Red Sox.
86 Red Sox, yes, yes.
Dennis Lamp, yeah.
Dennis Lamp, yeah. Well, he was a starter in the rotation with the 86 Red Sox, who, like we talked before, the Mookie Wilson game, the sixth game, that ground ball through the legs of Billy Buckner. Sure. No, I remember him.
Kind of looks like Buckner, doesn't he? Yeah, He's got that big mustache and the bushy eyebrows.
But that was a fashion then, I guess, in the 80s, right?
That's why we that's why we give a cent for that, because everybody's wearing one of those. Yeah,
good-looking mustache, too.
That mustache is 1 cent. That's all that one's worth. Bill Wilkinson. I'm not familiar with this. A lefty for the Seattle Mariners.
I remember the name, but I don't think he was in the rotation at all. He might have been. I feel sorry for the Mariners. The only team has not won a World Series.
Haven't gotten to a World Series.
Haven't gotten, right?
Yeah.
I let my co-host know about that.
When they won 116 games, I mean, how can you not go to the World Series if you win 116?
It's the same reason the A's didn't win that 88 World Series. Yeah. So that card is not worth anything.
Okay.
Speaking of Greg Maddox, here is a Cubs leader card, and that is definitely Greg Maddox there. So right off the bat, that's 5 cents, and then he's got real stirrups, so that's 6 cents.
6 cents, that's good.
It's probably going to be all, these leader cards are never really worth anything, but that's a good-looking card because look at, he looks good in those pinstripes.
Yes, he does. Yeah, well.
Let's see who the leaders on these teams, the Hawk, Andre Dawson, Rafael Palmeiro, there's a Cuban.
Yeah, I know him well.
Ryan Sandberg, Sean Dunstan, Rick Sutcliffe, and Greg Maddox.
Those are all great players. Yeah. Those are the stars. They're all stars.
And that was in 89, they lost to the Giants in the NLCS. That's when Will Clark hit that grand slam off of Maddox in Wrigley Field. Yeah.
And that's when the Hank Greenwell said, for the first time, the Giants.
Yeah. All right, so here we go. Rick Rodin, the New York Yankees.
Yeah. Didn't he pitch for the Dodgers, too? I think he did.
I remember him from the Yankees. I think he went on to be a pitching coach, didn't he?
Yeah.
Well, he was a good pitcher. He was a starter. Yeah, sure. He was a starter, yeah.
So that card's not worth anything, but he does have that mustache. So there's 1 cent. Oh, here's an old-timer right there. Jerry Royce.
Wow, that's the typical L.A. guy. I think he was from L.A., from Los Angeles.
Let's see.
He's a pitcher from the White Sox.
Home La Canada, California.
Yeah, La Canada.
Goes back to 69.
Yeah, no, he pitched for a while. Yeah, I remember him. He was a starter. Sure.
I mean, but this goes to show you that back in the, especially in the 90s and the 80s, if you were a left-handed pitcher, you could until your arm fell off, somebody was going to sign you. But that card is not worth anything, but he does have that mustache, so you do get 1 cent from that. Gary Reedus, I remember him. He was...
For the Pirates.
Yeah, he was when Bonds and Bonilla were on, and Van Slyke and...
Andy Van Slyke, yes. Yeah. And that Bonilla was supposed to be the big thing, right? And Bonds turned to be... Yeah, but people forget in that, we're talking about that team, that if I'm not mistaken, Barry Bonds was a leadoff hitter.
Yes, he was. Skinny Barry Bonds.
Skinny Barry Bonds. Yeah. His waist size was like 28 inches. Then he came here and he became Superman.
Yeah. We wonder how that happens. Now, this is a guy, I was actually just corresponding with one of his relatives on Twitter. Unfortunately, he's not with us anymore. He passed away. He had a lot of problems with substances.
Yeah, make rest in peace. Yeah, he was
Ken Caminiti.
He took a lot of drugs, I hate to say, and that's the truth. He was a very good player. Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Very good player.
when he would come through Atlanta, right. I'd be down on the field during batting practice, right. And I'd walk past him, and his shoulders right. And back were so right. Broad. Yeah. He looked like he could snap a bat like
strong
a twig.
Guy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Strong guy.
So that card is not worth anything, but he does have real stirrups on, so that'll get you a cent. Now, this is a number one draft pick overall. I remember this name. I don't think he ever did anything.
I don't think so.
Monty Ferris for the Texas Rangers. Here he is in an Oklahoma State uniform.
I don't think. He was a minor league, basically, and came up for a couple of years. Well, he wasn't. He didn't amount to much, unless he got hurt. But I remember the name, too.
Yeah,
I don't remember much of him because he probably didn't play a lot.
Yeah, I don't think he did. That card is worth 8 cents, though. Yeah. I'll give you an extra cent because he's got real stirrups on there. So that's not a bad card.
Collector's item.
Yeah. His mom would probably love that. And then our final, I know I've never heard of this guy.
No.
Jim Pankovitz.
No. I haven't seen the back of the card, but he played 5 years. It's too many. Maybe three.
There he is, 5 years exactly at this point, with an average of 250. But he is got a mustache on there, so you do get 1 cent for that.
Okay, so let's see how what's the tally here.
So that is 45 cents.
Oh, all right.
So let's look just at our leaderboard here. That 45 cents puts you in second place all time.
Who's from Julio Cruz?
Diamonds and Roses, which is a podcast about baseball in Oregon.
Oh, okay.
They pulled a Ken Griffey Jr. card.
Wow.
Out of an 89 upper deck.
One of my favorites, yeah.
Yeah, or not an 89, a 90 upper deck. Yeah. And then another podcast had 42. I think you might know Tom Hudler, the PA voice of the Mariners. He had 34. So you beat him, you can hold that over his head.
Okay, well, I'll see him at the end. Well, I'm glad.
All right. Well, Amari, we would like to thank you so much.
My pleasure.
We really enjoyed talking to you.
My pleasure. I hope to see you at a game sometime. I appreciate it. I hope your fans enjoy it, and go baseball.
All right, so that'll do it for another episode of Two Strike Noise. We'd like to once again thank our very special guest, Amari P. Gonzalez, for joining us. That was a lot of fun.
The man has stories from a long time and having a career in baseball. It's pretty awesome.
He certainly did. We'd also like to thank all of our listeners. As we do every week, we really do appreciate you tuning in. We've had a lot of messages through Twitter the last couple of weeks from people, frankly, all over the world, which is kind of cool. And we really enjoy hearing from everybody. We really enjoy talking baseball. And again, appreciate everybody for tuning in. If by any chance you wanted to rate or review us on whatever platform you're listening to us on, that is always great and appreciated. If you want to interact with us, you can follow us on either Twitter or Instagram. We are at Two Strike Noise. That is at TWO Strike Noise. We will be happy to talk to you there. We also post a lot of things. We're doing something really cool here during spring training. It's called the Spring Training Challenge, and it is has to do with posting a different baseball card every day of the week. Depending on, there's a different theme every day that has been put forth, and we've been keeping up with that. That's been a lot of fun to try and find these baseball cards, and that's something I've really enjoyed doing. So, Mark, I don't know. We're getting close to actual spring training games. I think there's no reason we shouldn't do another show next week. What do you say?
I think maybe we should do 4 or 5. Actually, you know what? I'm looking at my schedule. Let's just do one.
Okay, just one. That's probably enough.
Yeah.
People probably had enough. Just once a week is probably more than
enough. We don't want to like push it too hard and then have them hate us.
No. Not more than they already do.
So. No.
All right. Well, Mark, that was good. Let's regroup next week, and we will do another episode of Two Strike Noise.
Thank you. God bless you. Have a great day.